Holly Robbins, who will talk to us about Gobi.
Thank you, and thank you for staying around for the last talk in this session. So I'm the director of the Gobi project. I was brought on board at the end of May this year. Since then, we've been putting a lot of work into forming a development team and starting work on the project, but we're still pretty early in the development of the system. So I don't have a lot here to present today in terms of functionality of a system. So what I'm going to talk about is some of the driving factors behind, you know, why we're doing the Gobi project, and also talk a little bit about our strategy moving forward in terms of our development and the architecture of the system that we're trying to build. Before I get into that, I'd just like to acknowledge our partners in this endeavor. So we're being funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and we're working with Boyce Thompson Institute, United States Department of Agriculture, CIMMYT, ICRISAT, and ERIE. With CIMMYT, we're working primarily with the wheeze and maize. ICRISAT, we're working with chickpea and sorghum. ERIE, of course, with rice. And I'm based out of Cornell University. So genomic selection is something that's been in development for quite a while. There's obviously been a lot of studies out there looking at developing the models, developing methodologies, and developing methods to integrate this into breeding programs. However, to date, this has not become routine use in breeding programs in Sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. And I would say it's not just limited to those breeding programs. There's a lot of investment that needs to go into integrating genomic selection into a large-scale breeding program. And I'd say outside of some of the big, well-funded industrial breeding programs, there's still a lot of work left to do to be able to routinely implement this. One of the challenges with implementing genomic selection is dealing with the genomic information. So this is, you know, very high volume, high dimensional data. You need to have effective data management tools to be able to work with this. You need to be able to effectively integrate genotypic and phenotypic information. And you have to have good analysis pipelines that are able to turn, you know, these large quantities of data into useful information that breeders can rely on to make decisions in their breeding programs. So the Gobi project is going to be focusing on putting in place the systems, databases, tools, and analytical pipelines that will allow the pram breeders to be able to make decisions based off of genomic information. And the hope is that by providing these tools and integrating with some of the other pieces that are necessary to deploy genomic selection, that we can increase the rate of genetic gain in a lot of these key staple food crops in developing countries. So I'm not going to talk a lot about what genomic selection is. I think that probably most of you in the room are very familiar with it. However, I'd like to highlight that when we talk about genomic selection, we're not changing the fundamentals of breeding here. We're still looking at the same driving factors in response to selection, response to and genetic gain. So we have selection intensity, selection accuracy, the amount of genetic variability we have to work with, and generation interval. And ideally, you want to increase the numerator and decrease the denominator. It's more challenging than it may seem. It's often an optimization problem because as you increase one, it can have a negative correlation with some of the other factors. For instance, if I'm running a breeding program, I may want to screen a lot of lines in my early stages. By screening a lot of lines, I can increase my selection intensity. I can increase my genetic variability, but because I have fewer reps in the field to test this with, I'm going to decrease my accuracy. And what genomic selection can do is it can help, it won't eliminate these negative correlations, but it certainly can help us shift the equation in the right direction. So we're going to look at a very generic breeding scheme here and how we might be able to deploy genomic selection within a breeding scheme. Typically, you have early stage screening here. You're dealing with lots of lines, very few reps. Unfortunately, in breeding, what often happens is you make your heaviest cuts at the very early stages where you have the least amount of information. And so it's inevitable that you make quite a few mistakes here early on. This is followed by a characterization stage where you're looking at a lot more replications in multiple environments, and finally a release. There's really two areas that genomic selection can come to play. One is in the early stage screening. So you can utilize genomic selection to discard lines that have a low likelihood of success. This can do a couple of things. One is it can allow you to screen more germplasm, assuming that you're able to collect these genotypic information at a cheaper cost than what you're paying to screen them in the field. You can also increase your selection intensity by making heavy cuts early on in your breeding scheme. And you can also save resources in your early stage plots that can then reallocate to get more accuracy on your lines and your initial phenotypic screens. By being able to utilize more plots on a fewer number of lines early in the scheme, you can get some better accuracy, which can in turn allow you to make some earlier decisions about what you want to recycle back into your breeding program as parents of the next generation, which can potentially impact your generation interval. So there's certainly a lot of areas or a lot of places in which genomic selection could integrate into a breeding scheme. But of course, this is all dependent on the accuracy of the genomic selection. And so, you know, one of the key questions often is, well, how accurate does it really need to be before I can deploy this effectively within a breeding program? And I'd just like to state that there are a lot of key drivers in how accurate genomic selection is going to be. There's obviously the genetic architecture and heritability of the trait. These aren't necessarily things that we can control, but certainly, you know, based off the type of trait that you're working on, some are going to be easier to model with genomic selection than others. There's the models. I'm a quantitative geneticist by training, so I've done a lot of work in modeling, and it does hurt me to say that typically it's not the models that are a limiting factor in terms of your ability to get the accuracies you need to get. It really is your training populations and your data sets. You need to have good training populations that are designed to be targeted towards what you're predicting in terms of the environments and the germplasm representative. And you need to have good quality data, and you need to have a lot of data to be able to get these types of accuracies. And that's where a system like Gobi can really come into play. It's the ability to manage this data, the ability to access this data and feed it into your training sets. And so that still, begs the question, you know, are we at a point now where we can get the accuracies that we need to get for genomic selection? So this is taken from a good review paper, Lynn et al. In Crop and Pasture Science in 2014. And in this, they have a table where they've just looked at many, many studies. They've looked at cross-validation accuracies across different species, across different traits, across different models. And this is just plotted out in a histogram here. You can see that the accuracy of the cross-validation went anywhere from, you know, pretty close to zero all the way up to one. I'd imagine that as you get out towards the high accuracy end, you're talking about traits that are probably controlled by some large effect genes that have relatively simple architecture. And then as you get, to the other side, you're dealing with more complex traits. Now, of course, one of the challenges is that the traits that you're going to get the most value out of genomic selection on tend to be the more complex traits with the lower heritabilities, which also tend to be the ones that you get lower correlations in terms of your genomic prediction accuracy. Here's just sometimes it helps to visualize these things, so visualizing, what a correlation of 0.5 or 0.3 looks like and what that could mean, especially if you're going to deploy genomic selection early in a breeding program. So here I have simulated data where on the x-axis you have the estimated value or the genomic prediction. On the y-axis, you have what we're calling the true genetic value of this line. If I were to make a pretty heavy cut where these green lines are in terms of everything above this line is what I want to keep, that represents about 2% of this data, so that's a pretty heavy selection intensity there. At a correlation of 0.5, if I were going to deploy genomic selection in terms of early discarding, and I'm looking at really three different calling rates here. So to your right would be dropping the bottom 70% based off of estimates, 50%, and then 30%. What you can see is there's two ways that you can really look at the efficacy of genomic selection here. One is, if I'm going to cut a bunch of lines prior to going into my field screen, how many of my really good lines am I going to lose? And two is, what is going to be the frequency or the proportion of the lines that I end up testing that are the good lines? And what we can see is if I do no genomic selection at all, obviously I'm not going to lose any of my top lines, but my top lines are going to be about 2% of the lines that I'm testing in the field, at least by this definition. At 70%, you can see we're losing some top lines, but we have a very significant enrichment for the number of top lines that we're testing in the field. And we've also greatly reduced the number of lines that we have to use our resources on, our phenotypic resources. And you can see that carries through down through 30%. Correlation of 0.3, now we're getting into some more challenging correlations. If you look at this plot, it looks kind of like a blob, not a real clear regression line there. But the trend really still holds true. Now, if you're gonna do a heavy selection with that, you're going to lose a lot of your good lines. But you can still significantly enrich the proportion of good lines that you're testing in the field, even at some of these lower correlations. And so I would say that depending on what your breeding objectives are, depending on how much risk you're willing to take, that with some of the cross-validation accuracies that we see now, I think that genomic selection is at a point where we can start to routinely deploy it into a breeding program. Now, as I said before, there's a lot that has to come together to actually be able to do this on a routine basis. Underlying all of this is your breeding strategy. Breeding strategies are going to vary from crop to crop and geography to geography, and I think they are going to ultimately drive what is the optimal deployment of genomic selection within a breeding program. But regardless of what the strategy is, there are a lot of fundamental capabilities that you have to have in place. So you have to have high-quality data, phenotypic, environmental, and genomic. You have to have effective data management systems in place. You have to have good analysis pipelines to turn that data into information. And then you have to have skilled breeders. You need to get the right information to the right people at the right time. And we're talking about crops that are generally putting as many cycles into a year as they possibly can, so the turnaround times on this are pretty tight often. When we talk about the GOBI project, what we're focusing on is really the genomic information piece of this. We're initially targeting effective data management, and we're going to be building analysis pipelines on top of that and visualizations to help deliver that data to the breeders to make the choices they need to make. So there's a lot of challenging data coming out in terms of GBS data. I mean, it's very high dimensional. It's also a little bit random in terms of what genotypes you end up getting, so what you have and what you don't have in terms of missing data. It makes it very challenging to work with. However, there's a lot of data already out there in these breeding programs, and they simply can't afford to wait for a long time while we try and figure out what a truly next-gen solution is. And so our initial phase strategy is to try and get a functional system out there to help these breeding programs manage the information that they currently have. And to do that, we want to leverage existing components to the fullest extent possible. We want to be able to effectively communicate with other systems. So those of you that have been here for most of the talks have heard a lot of people talk about the BRAAPI, or the Plant Breeding API. We plan to fully adopt that system and communicating with other systems. And we want to quickly piece together a system to meet the immediate needs of these breeding programs and to help us buy some of the time that we have, that we need to develop a truly next-gen solution in phase two of the project. So this is just a high-level look at the design that we're putting together here for our first phase. When we talk about genomic information, we're really partitioning this into three major types of data. So we have the metadata, so this is going to be information on samples, information on the markers. These are going to be key pieces of information that we need to link to whatever field trial system, management system is being adopted, as well as the lab information management systems being adopted. We have sequence data, and so these would be short reads coming off the machines, being used for the alignments, being used for variant calls, being used for imputation. And so this data is really the rawest form of the data, so we want to keep this because every time we have some changes to reference genomes or we have changes to the methodologies that we're going to use for imputation, we're going to want to go back to this data, but we're not going to want to necessarily access this in a transactional way. And then we have the marker variant data, and so this is where we're going to put the variant calls. And this is honestly probably one of the most challenging pieces of developing a database like this, because when you talk about GBS data, you're talking about data that is high dimensional enough that if you're going to put this in a traditional relational database, that they simply start to fall apart in terms of being able to load the data in particular as well as query in a reasonable amount of time. We're going to put a extract transform load layer on top of this, an ETL. because we envision that as we go down the road of developing this, there's going to be a lot of changes on the data warehouse end. We don't necessarily want to be having applications built directly on top of these databases, because we want to be able to switch them out as easily as possible without disrupting some of the other functionality of the project. So to dig in a little bit with our metadata. So with the metadata, certainly the amount of information stored here in this metadata can grow to be quite large, but we're not foreseeing, at least in the near future, that it's going to grow so large that some of the more traditional database schemas and relational databases are going to fall apart for us. And we are adopting a Chatto schema for this. So going back to leveraging existing components to the fullest extent possible, Erie already has been in development of a genomic information system, which they call G4R. It's based off of a subset of the Chatto schema. And we have decided that for the first phase of the project, we will be adopting the G4R system into the Gobi project. Chatto, as mentioned before, it's nice because it's abstract. It allows you to easily work with multiple species, multiple crops. It's not a very intuitive database schema, so the first time you look at it, it really doesn't make much sense at all. It can be a little challenging to query, but since we're going to have a middle layer on top of it, we're not as concerned about that. For marker variants, we're going to start out with a SQL solution, but we're going to phase that out as quickly as possible. We don't want to jump straight into NoSQL type of solutions, although they're certainly on the table, things like Cassandra, things like HBase, MongoDB. But in our initial look at alternatives, we're going to look at some of the columnar store databases. And these databases, if we look at Citus and Greenplum, are extensions of Postgres. They allow you to shard data over multiple nodes. This enables you to split the data out and parallelize your queries to get some more efficiency in terms of being able to query large blocks of data. We're also going to be looking at Monet, and in particular T3 is going to be doing some proof of concept test with the Monet system. Sequence data, the plan is to store this on FASTQ files. We'll include a file search tool, as well as an interface to allow people to grab those files and run them through imputation and SNP calling algorithms as quickly as possible. We will be including bioinformatics pipelines on the back end to do the calling and imputation. There are pipelines already available for the crops that we're working on, so in the early phase, the hope is just to integrate in the pipelines that are already being used for those crops. So this has been talked about before, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, other than to mention that the first version of this is going to be released in PAG 2016, so if you're interested in it, I would encourage you to attend that. From our standpoint, we're going to have to communicate with our field trial management systems to grab our phenotypic information. And when we're looking at CIMA, ICRISAT, and ERIE, at this point in time, those three centers are not all going to be adopting the same field trial management system, so we're going to have to be able to connect with more than one. Being able to go through an API certainly is going to help standardize those connections. And we also want, on the user end, as we've gone and talked to the breeders at a lot of these CG centers, they all have their favorite tools that they like to use. They all have certain analysis pipelines that they like to be able to use for making their advancement decisions. And we don't really want to have to replace those. And so the idea is that by using an API system, we can develop a plug-and-play system that can allow users to direct current software they're using towards our database and be able to pull data into those systems for analysis. For our ETL, the middle layer here, in terms of the design of the system, we're putting together to insulate the users from a lot of the back-end changes. Right now we're exploring Kettle for the use of the middle layer. This is nice because it allows you to pipe in a lot of different functionalities, so you can combine querying multiple databases with calculating statistics on those and doing filtering. Genomic analysis pipelines, the plan is to have those on a server end, on a computational cluster. So these would be, you know, heavy genomic analysis tools, association mapping, genomic selection. PCOA is something that's very commonly requested by the breeding groups. We plan to take full advantage of Tassel plugins. We've already started working with the Tassel group to develop some Gobi-specific plugins. There was a hackathon back in October that we participated in, and hopefully some of that functionality will be distributed out with Tassel in the near future. On the client side, we're looking at developing some interfaces for the middle layer, as well as being able to do data visualizations on the client side and implement some of the analysis pipelines. In terms of distribution, we're not looking to be a data manager for any of these breeding programs. The idea is to develop a system that we can deploy out and people can adopt and put their own data into. We understand that not everyone's going to be running on the same operating systems and same hardware configurations that we're doing our development on. So the plan is to deliver the system in Docker containers. This can give users the flexibility to deploy this on their own servers or to take this into the cloud if that's what their IT strategy is. So we divided this up, our initial work up, into multiple work packages. So we're doing, right now we're working with the CG centers to do a lot of breeding workflow mapping. You have to understand the breeding processes and the breeding strategies to be able to develop tools for it. Again, we're leveraging existing capabilities and systems for our initial version of the data warehouse. The server-side application, we're going to be deploying bioinformatic pipelines and genomic analysis pipelines. There's a lot of these available, and we plan to utilize those as much as possible. The API is going to be Broppy. We're currently evaluating ETL tools, but it looks like Kettle is what we're going to be going with. And on the client side, we'll have GUIs for submitting queries and connecting to existing tools. You know, so in summary, we do feel that genomic selection is in a place that it is ready for deployment into breeding programs. The CG centers need effective data management, so that's our highest priority right now. And phase two will be looking to handle some of the more challenging data sets. We've got a great team together. We're still filling positions, but we have our core development team in place, and we look to have something more to show at PAG. So with that, thank you. I don't know if we have any time for questions. But we have to take them.
I can have a quick question since we're at the end, if there's one.
Yes.
More of a point of thought. When dealing with breeders, Ted Wilson, Texas A&M, and I run the Rice Research Center in Texas, the number of lines that a breeder will evaluate will be anywhere from roughly 5,000 to 20,000 a year. So the number of phenotypic traits, field-based phenotypic traits, they measure is typically very limited. My argument is that, or the question I have is, the traits that they're measuring are historically convenient. Mm-hmm. What if those aren't the traits they should be measuring, and how will you change the direction or help change the direction to focus on phenotypic traits that are more relevant?
I honestly don't know a lot about rice specifically. It's not a crop I've worked with a lot in the past. But I would say that genomic selection, I think, has the ability to enable predictions on traits that maybe are more relative for early stage screening. Maybe it's just because you can't collect those traits early on or it's very inconvenient. It is a bit of a challenge, though, in the sense that you have to have lots of phenotypic information to be able to train a good genomic prediction model. And so there's a bit of a chicken and egg problem, which is you got to have lots of good phenotypic information to be able to predict. If it's a trait that's very hard to measure or very hard to get a lot of phenotypic information on, it's hard to get the models trained. And so there does have to be a bit of a compromise there, and I would guess that it would have to be on a trait-by-trait basis, really figuring out what that appropriate compromise is going
to
be.
Be glad to talk to you later.
Yeah, no, that'd be great. Yeah.
All right, well, that concludes this afternoon's symposium. Let's thank Kelly and all the rest of the speakers who had the session.